Good morning. I understand why Dorothy thought George was five. He's kind of big. He's a big kid. But yeah, George is five, and Francis is about a year and a half. And I made the mistake on my, I guess it was a couple days ago, telling George just offhandedly, oh yeah, California's on fire. And so apparently, well, his first reaction was to say, oh no, we need to send the firemen. His delayed reaction was apparently last night he was asking his mom whether I'd been burned in the fire. So, but when I responded back to the text, she's like, oh, don't worry, he's not concerned, just curious. I hope he'd be concerned. So I'll be reading three scriptures this morning. First one's from 1 Kings 17:8-16. Then the word of the Lord came to him, being Elijah. Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you. So he arose and went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, bring me a little water in a vessel that I may drink. And as she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. And she said, as the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of meal in a jar and a little oil in a cruse. I think that means a jar too. And now I'm going to gather a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. And Elijah said to her, fear not, go and do as you have said, but first make me a little cake of it and bring it to me, and afterward make it for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of meal shall not be spent, and the jar of oil shall not fail, until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth. And she did and went as Elijah said, and she and he and her household ate for many days. The jar of meal was not spent, neither did the jar of oil fail, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Elijah. Second scripture is from Hebrews 9:24-28. For Christ has entered not into a sanctuary made with hands, a copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Nor was it to offer himself repeatedly, as the high priest enters the holy place yearly with blood not his own. For then he would have had to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared once and for all at the end of the age to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And just as it is appointed for men to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. Finally, I'll be reading from Mark 12:38-44. And in Jesus' teaching, he said, beware of the scribes who like to go about in long robes and to have salutations in the marketplaces and the best seats in the synagogues and the places of honor at feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation. And he sat down opposite the treasury and watched the multitude putting money into the treasury. Many rich people put in large sums, and a poor widow came and put in 2 copper coins, which make a penny. And he called his disciples to him and said to them, truly I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the treasury, for they all contributed out of their abundance. But she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, her whole living. It can be hard to believe in times like these. Hard to believe in a God that allows a world of migrant caravans, smoke-filled skies, climate-fueled natural disasters, and a rising movement of authoritarian nationalism. It can be hard to believe in a Christianity that so often sides with the wealthy and with the powerful, with the violent and the arrogant. Based on what we see on the national and world stage, it can be a challenge to believe that human beings are capable of anything beyond self-interest, self-preservation, and self-deception. I was talking with a friend recently who's a very faithful person and was telling me that he was having a difficult time believing. And this is a person I've ministered with for many years. He says, I'm on the struggle train. I have a tough time believing. I said to him, you know, you're not alone. There's this spiritual weight that's fallen over us as a people. I don't know if it's the whole world, but certainly in this country. Many of us are feeling the temptation to despair right now. Despair tells us things won't get better. They always get worse. People don't change. What's the point in trying? As human beings, we don't lose hope because life is hard. We lose hope because life seems to have lost all sense of possibility, all long-term meaning and legacy. This was the kind of lurking despair that Elijah found when he visited Zarephath. The land was dying. The food was almost gone. No one and nothing could save the widow and her child. It hadn't rained in the whole region for years. The famine was severe. What more could be done? Maybe it was just time to give up and die. When Elijah showed up at the gates of Zarephath, he found this widow doing the only thing she knew how to do, gathering sticks to start a fire, to cook a last meal for herself and her son. And so as she stands there gathering kindling, a stranger appears, begging for food. Bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. Now, I don't know what the widow thought when Elijah approached her. I don't know because it doesn't say so in the text. But I know what I would be thinking if I were in her place. Bring you a morsel of bread? Bring you a morsel of bread? My family is getting ready to starve to death, and you want me to bring you food? Go sell crazy somewhere else. We're all full up here. The widow is a lot kinder than I would have been. And maybe she's afraid. She says, "As the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of meal in a jar and a little oil in a jug." That sounds kind of familiar to me. I've done that before. Have you ever done that? "Sorry, man, I don't have any cash on me." It's technically true. But it's a polite way of saying, "I don't want to help." And why should she, right? Why should she want to help? Generosity flows out of hope. And hope seems in very short supply. The widow tells the stranger, "I'm now gathering a couple of sticks so I may go home and prepare the last of our food for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die." That we may eat it and die. Things are getting real in Zarephath. So then Elijah makes a promise, an outrageous, ridiculous promise. "Give me some food, and God will take care of you and your son. Everything's going to be okay." He says, "Do not be afraid. Go and do as you have said, but first, make me a little cake and bring it to me. And afterwards, go make some food for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord God of Israel, the jar of meal will not be emptied and the jug of oil will not fail until the day the Lord sends rain on the earth." Now, seriously, again, can you believe this guy? Don't worry, lady, it's all going to be fine. Just go make me some food first before you feed yourself and your son. And if you do that, God is going to make the little bit of food you have left last for years. Would you believe a stranger telling you that? Now again, the text is very, very sparse on details. So we don't know why the widow did what she did. We don't know what her emotional reaction was. There might have been even more conversation that they didn't write down. But at the end of the day, she did what Elijah asked. And God did what Elijah said. The prophet stayed with them for many days. And the three of them had enough to eat. The jar of meal never ran out. And the jug of oil never ran dry. The widow at Zarephath trusted in Elijah and in his God, because it wasn't her God. She was a foreigner in Sidon. And that leap of faith, that leap of utter desperation, paid off. Elijah truly was a holy man, and his God was faithful. In our gospel reading this morning, Jesus talks about some other holy men, so-called. In Mark 12, the important holy men of Jerusalem are demanding to know by what authority Jesus has disrupted the holy precincts, chasing the money changers out of the temple. In response, and this is stuff we didn't read this morning, this was before. In response, Jesus tells a parable comparing the religious leaders to murderous thieves. And then they try to trip him up with questions about paying taxes, the nature of the resurrection, and debates about who the Messiah is. And so at the end of all this, right, Jesus cleared the temple, and then he's basically in a verbal street brawl with several other different groups in the temple. At the end of all that, we come to our passage for this morning, where he says, "Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and to be greeted with respect in the marketplaces and to have the best seats in the synagogues in place of honor at banquets. They devour widows' houses and for the sake of appearance say long prayers. They will receive the greater condemnation." Elijah ate what the widow had to offer and received her food as an offering to God. And as a sign of God's favor, God miraculously multiplied the meal and the oil, saving the lives of the widow and her son. And we see echoes of this story in Jesus' feeding of the 5,000. When we offer up what we have to God, there's enough to go around. Now, the religion of the temple in Jesus' time was an entirely different character, entirely different type of religion from the prophetic faith of Elijah. The widow's gift to Elijah was a leap of faith, but tithes to the temple were a tax imposed by a wealthy elite. Elijah lived on the margins, fleeing the wrath of a corrupt king. The temple was the very seat of power. So in the traditional Jewish cosmology, there were different gradations of holiness depending on where you were. And so lands outside Israel were less holy than Israel. Israel was the holiest land. And in the holiest land, there was the holiest place, the temple. And as you got further and further into the temple, it got holier and holier, right? And that's where the center of power was, because that's where the holiness was. The story of Elijah takes place in the least holy place possible, way out in Sidon with people who didn't believe in the God of Israel. The temple was home to the best and brightest. Zarephath was full of unclean outsiders who had nothing left and were preparing to die. The rulers of the temple demanded religious devotion and economic sacrifice. But Elijah comes as a beggar and offers good news to the poor. So the second part of our reading from Mark is the famous widow's mite story, or the widow's offering. And it says that Jesus sat down opposite the treasury and watched people putting money in. And lots of rich people came by and donated large sums. And then finally, a poor widow came and put in a couple of copper coins, which is worth practically nothing. And Jesus says, well, look at that. Look at what she just did. Truly, I tell you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the treasury. For all of them have contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, all she had to live on. Now, most of us have probably heard this story before, and most of us have probably heard the common interpretation before, which is that Jesus is praising the widow for her faith. That while all the other wealthy donors gave out of their abundance, the widow gave in a self-sacrificial way, through her willingness to surrender everything for her faith in the temple. She demonstrates the kind of risk-taking that Jesus wants to see in his disciples. Now, I like that interpretation, but I don't think that's what Jesus is talking about here. In the context we're seeing it, Jesus has just disrupted the temple, and he's just been in fights with the people who run the temple. In this context, the story of the widow's offering starts looking less like a model of faithfulness and more like a story of economic oppression. Now, superficially, it would seem like the widow's gift at the temple has a lot in common with the widow's gift at Zarephath. In both cases, a marginalized, impoverished woman living on the edge gives everything that she has to live on. They both give it to holy men who claim to have a higher purpose for asking for the resources they need. But the holy men of the temple don't possess the same character as Elijah. The widow at Zarephath took a leap of faith to feed a prophet on the run, a prophet being hunted by an abusive and unfaithful king in Israel. The widow at Jerusalem gave away everything she had to live on to satisfy the demands of an abusive and unfaithful temple system, men who devour widows' houses and for the sake of appearances say long prayers. The faith of Elijah relieves poverty and famine, but the temple's tithing system exacerbates it. So, where do we find ourselves in these scriptures? Because the temple was a long time ago, and we don't have a temple. That's not how our society works anymore. So what does this mean for us? What does it mean to live in the faith of Elijah, the faith of the margins, the prophetic faith that stands with the poor and the widow and the hungry? Do we do that? Or have we been seduced by the spectacle and violence of our modern day temple? Because the religion, there is, you know, we don't have a temple that we all face towards and look at as a center of holiness, right? We don't literally have a temple. But the religion of the temple is still very much alive in our world today. That religion is the faith of Wall Street, the faith of the Pentagon, the faith of Silicon Valley. It's the prosperity gospel that tells us we get what we've earned, and the rich deserve to run the show, and the poor deserve to eat their last meal and die. This kind of religion centers on the people and the institutions that already have a lot, and it says that they should be given more. This is the kind of faith that devours widows' homes and for the sake of appearances says long prayers. Jesus and Elijah offer us an alternative to this way of empire. They stand in the prophetic tradition, the way of the wilderness, the revelation of the burning bush. They teach us a way of utter dependence on God, the way of the cross. It's a way of liberation. To walk with Jesus is to hear the voice of God calling us on the tattered edge of empire, commanding us to say to Pharaoh, "Let my people go." The prophetic faith of Jesus turns its back on the center, on the holy places, on the important, the wise. In order to embrace those who are rejected and despised. In days like these, when skies are filled with smoke and refugees stream northward seeking refuge and safety, in times when political power seems bankrupt of moral authority, we're tempted to despair, to gather sticks so that we can cook our food and die. In our hunger for a faith that can speak to our distress, Jesus and Elijah present us with two different paths that we can choose. Will we put our faith in the God of Moses, who challenges oppressive structures and liberates people from bondage? Will we walk in the faith of Jesus, who surrendered everything, his life and his dignity, to open up the door to healing and reconciliation? Or will we pick the way of the temple? Will we be like the scribes, riding high on our own sense of moral authority? Will we place burdens on the poor and the marginalized that they can't bear? Will we side with the economic and political system that's choking our planet and tearing families apart? Will we allow our hopelessness to congeal into cynicism? Will we seek personal advantage in a time of societal breakdown? As followers of Jesus, we don't have to guess about which path we're called to. Our God is the Holy One of the wilderness, of the margins. He stands with the widow and the orphan, the poor and the oppressed, the migrant caravans, and the child laborers who make our clothing and electronics. God dwells with those who our economic system is crushing. On the cross, Jesus bears the suffering of the weeping parents and the hungry children. In his resurrection power, he invites us to the ministry of reconciliation, turning away from the glitz and glamour of celebrity power and turning towards the daily needs of those who have been cast away by our society. Will we heed this call? Will we become like the prophet Elijah, approaching the widow at Zarephath for food, offering good news to the poor? The prophet does not command obedience through his or her own wealth and power. Elijah did not come to Zarephath as someone superior and worthy of respect. He came as a homeless beggar. Like Jesus and the early disciples, he carried nothing with him but the clothes on his back and the good news of God's salvation. Liberation for the poor and justice for the oppressed. In these times of darkness, when we're tempted to despair, Jesus and Elijah offer us a way forward, a way of peace and life, a way of releasing our fear and embracing trust in God by serving those most in need, by embracing our place as humble beggars in the house of God. We can find our way through this time of drought and famine. And together with the friends that God will reveal to us, we might even find hope.